Weight loss solutions are not one-size-fits-all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert-guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
Hello, and welcome to episode 212 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rotta, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Artificial intelligence is rapidly integrating into everyday life, and one of the fastest-growing applications is the chatbot, a program designed to engage in conversations that feel surprisingly human. Tech companies are embedding them into social media, search engines, and messaging apps, where millions of teens and adults are already using them as helpers or companions. But recent news reports, including a Washington Post investigation into Meta's chatbot and new parental controls announced by OpenAI after a teen suicide, show how high the stakes can be. Rick, we'll get into the details here in a second, but I just wanted to start today's show with perhaps the biggest possible question. At this very moment, do you think the world would be better if AI simply went away, or are the promises too enticing that we'd miss out on a better world?
If it was just one or the other, we'd be better off if AI went away.
Really?
But here's what I think should happen.
Okay. But that's not going to go away.
No, I think that AI should be treated as a very powerful but potentially dangerous tool. And what we do in those cases, we limit the use to certain kinds of uses where we know that the harms might justify some of the risks. And that would mean for AI right now, like all the promises are, this is going to help us in research. This is going to help
medical research, could save lives, things like that.
Things like that. Where it's mostly being used is for new forms of entertainment. And inventing new uses for it, like saying that it's going to improve learning and education, like introducing it into the schools. There's no proven benefit. There's a lot of concern about harm. It should not be used in any of these speculative areas. So it should really be restricted to very specific professional uses and not released to the public.
And I hear you say that, and I can't imagine there weren't people like you saying those same things when the internet was turning from a really kind of tool for people in higher learning institutions that were connecting, like, you know, and we've all seen those maps of like, here's the first look of the internet. And there was like connections between like a few universities in California and across the country. And it was, just like you said, sort of used as a research and tool that, you know, help people share files back and forth. And as the internet turned from a research tool into something, well, that it has been for quite some time, first on people's home computers and now on everybody's devices and everybody's pockets, that I think some of those same concerns were probably raised. So, I mean, I guess I'll ask another big question before we get into some of the small questions, but like, do you feel the same about like the internet writ large? Would it have been better had this just stayed in some sort of tool for a select number of people to make selective things better and not invaded literally every corner of our lives?
10 years ago, I would have said no. Like, it's really been beneficial for just about everybody, because it certainly is convenient. It really enhances our power and ability to do all kinds of cool things. And of course, you know, like I, like you, and most other people use it every day for all kinds of things. I'm not so sure anymore. And I think the jury's still out on whether this might ultimately just destroy our society altogether. Not just AI,
the internet.
But the internet.
Yeah.
Like when we see what's happening to democracy in this country with the increased polarization, the rapid decline of trust in institutions, the decreasing mental health of young people especially, but in the increase of loneliness, like what it's doing to human relationships. And this isn't even with the ubiquitous presence of AI yet. This is just internet. I would say, like, this may turn out to be the worst thing that ever happened to humanity. And I liken it to when OxyContin first came out, you know, the production of like the brand name for oxycodone, and it was, so like this was revolutionary in providing pain relief to all kinds of people who are suffering
and had been suffering for a long time.
And it was, it's like it has very good therapeutic and recovery uses. But it was just given to all kinds of people. It was made easily available, and it just destroyed all kinds of lives before it was reined in and pulled back. And now we appropriately restrict it. I think AI is like that. Like what we're doing is we've invented something that's really powerful. It can have all these great uses, and we're just releasing it out to everybody. And we're already finding that it's destructive.
I don't necessarily 100% agree with your theory there, but I think we will agree that even if somehow we were able to, in a country that's so divided and so polarized, all come to the conclusion that we need to greatly throttle what AI is doing in this country. And that seems like a pretty difficult step to take. But somehow, if we were able to do that, I just don't see any way at all where we would, as a world, be able to do that, right? I mean, probably the U.S. is ahead in the AI race, but, you know, China is pushing quickly on this, and a lot of this has to do with, you know, building computer chips that can handle these complicated and difficult tasks. And you have all these countries sort of in this race, right? And if somehow, some way, the United States, or maybe even more likely some other smaller country says, you know, like, I'll just pick on I think of Iceland as like a really good example of kind of a small isolated country that I have no idea what they think about AI. But if they said, you know what, we're going to throttle this out of our country. We don't want it here. We're just going to make this sort of an AI-free zone. I mean, sure, I guess that's fine. But like the rest of the world's going to continue moving on. And I just don't know how, it's sort of like COVID in a way, right? That you can have that COVID zero policy that a few countries tried in 2020, but there's like no way to keep it out at all. So I just at this point think, and have, I guess, for some time, that these things are kind of like a contagion. And I think it's hard to say that there was anything good that came out of the COVID contagion, but I think there is like some positive that definitely could come out of this. Like, I think, I don't know the chances of this, but the chance is certainly not zero that one of us will live significantly longer because of an advance in AI. And like, I think that's good.
I think two things are likely. I think that it could really be beneficial for advances in all kinds of healthcare treatments.
Mm-hmm.
And it could also really increase the suicide rate of young people. And
I guess what you're saying, how do you balance, I'm generalizing here, but the deaths of more 15-year-olds to save the lives of a bunch of 75-year-olds.
Yeah, and what if it just decreases in general the quality of life? So we're living longer, but we're much less happy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do we balance that? And I don't think this is wild speculation. I think this is at least possible and even probable. I'm not arguing with you that it would be easy to regulate it, or maybe that it might even be possible in most respects to claw it back at this point. I'm just saying, like, in your question was kind of in a hypothetical world, what would be the best? It would be that, yeah, it's not released to the public. But here is where I think responsible and plausible restrictions could be done in schools. Microsoft is really pushing schools, pushing its AI product to be adopted in schools, K-12 all the way through, and in universities.
For students and teachers.
It's already destroying education. I mean, it's not helping learning. This is a false promise. They're claiming this. It's destroying learning. Because if you think learning is just about being able to access information, to answer questions and like pick up bits of information, yeah, it's going to be great at that. But that's actually the problem. Learning is about developing brains so that you increase your curiosity, so that you develop the ability to process information, to think clearly, to think logically and analytically. It's doing all that work for kids. And so it just destroying, that's the whole purpose of school. Let's just cancel school, because kids can click on a chatbots and chatbots can answer all the questions for them. We don't need school anymore. And I'm quite serious about this. If we're going to introduce AI into the classroom to assist with learning, then let's just give up on the education project altogether. And I don't think there's a happy medium here. I'm quite serious. Like, I think this is a terrible thing that Microsoft and OpenAI are doing, pushing this onto a public because, well, it's a profit motive. And they're in competition with other companies that they think are going to get the competitive advantage. But there's been no serious attempt to think, like, what are the actual effect on these institutions like our schools? What is it going to be the actual effect on a whole generation of kids that we're doing these experiments on them without even knowing what the results will be?
So I want to give you a real-world example. Obviously, I'm not in school, but this obviously, by definition, seeps into the workplace, and I wonder if some of your same concerns aren't felt there. So here's something that happened to me just the other day, is we have a team in our company that prepares a lot. You know, any big company has groups of people that provide reports about performance and analytics and all these things. And without going into too many of the boring details, they were sending out this report through a spreadsheet that had lots of good and interesting data for people that could be useful to learn about how people are consuming news on our websites across our company and all this good stuff. I was convinced, however, that although this data I'm sure was good and useful, that it was not like presented in a way that would make people want to dig into it. I mean, it would be like you'd really have to like either be pretty familiar with Excel or really dogged about like trying to find the information that you care about in this big report. There are people who are much smarter than me with Excel. I've seen people do things with Excel I have no idea how to do that. It's like really impressive and would probably take that data from that spreadsheet and put it into a really usable, almost intuitive sort of way to like, oh, I don't know much about Excel, but this is good information. This is useful. I'm going to use this and help me do my job. I don't have those skills in Excel. Could I learn them? I mean, I'm sure I could, right? I mean, it's not, you know, I would hope I'm a bright enough person I could figure that out. But I went in and used an AI program and said, here's this data we're getting, and I would like to present this in a way that and kind of explain the use case through this prompt in a way that it's useful and people can access. And like within an hour, probably a little less, I had a very rudimentary tool that's, you know, still working through some of the bugs, but like I believe, and I think others believe, could make this data more useful and actionable. What I did not do though, Rick, was I did not spend a lot of time learning Excel. I skipped over that entirely, but I had the outcome I wanted. Is that a problem in your mind?
No. And I think that's an example of where it can be very helpful. And we're already finding like some companies are finding that they have employees that can be much more productive because they use these powerful tools to get more done or get done things that might have taken hours and instead take minutes or had taken several employees to do and maybe takes one or two.
But I could have learned something that I'm not learning anymore in my example. Why is that not bother you?
Two things. You are a mature person.
Well, you will, some might disagree, but we'll go with that premise.
What I mean is you're old.
Would you rather have me put it
sure,
that way?
That's fine.
You're old but childlike. Like, you've already developed into your maturity. And so, like, if you're going to use tools, you're going to use them with already the capacity to exercise some judgment about how they're being used. And you've developed skills in other areas that let you exercise that kind of appropriate judgment. Where it's harmful is introducing these tools to kids who haven't learned that stuff. Their brains haven't developed. And it's two things. It's the development of skills, and it's the development of capacity for the brain to do this. So there's one, the development of skills. There's the development of general capacity in the brain. There's also like the development of things like relational intelligence, how to get along with people, how to work with people. Because one of the things we know that in any kind of work environment, what we're doing is working with other people. And when we're learning new skills and new abilities, what we're doing is we're learning how to get along, and we're making use of all those kinds of skills. If we develop tools that are able to interact just with you alone, so you don't have to talk to other people, you don't have to rely on anybody else to get the information or to pick up the skills, and we're introducing that at a very early age, we'll get people that just don't know how to get along in the world. And we don't know like what the ultimate effects of this will be later on in life. I'm really concerned that we have a lot of young people right now who feel useless. They feel useless because they don't see how they're contributing or how they're needed. And it's true, like we have so much technological capacity that like we have a lot of young people that spend most of their days being entertained. And then it's no surprise, you know, they get to be, you know, 15, 16, 17 years old, or they get even into their 20s. And they, how they'll express it is something like this: I don't feel like I belong. Right, so we have a real decline in this, like this feeling of belonging. That's kind of an ill-defined term, but it's generally like I don't feel like I'm part of a community that needs me. This is where it's really bad. Like, so what is the point of it? Like, if we have tools that do everything that we used to count on people to do, and we do it, that does it all for us, it doesn't just free our lives up to do things that are more important that we like. It frees us up to be useless. And I think that would be a disaster for humanity.
So I'm going to ask a question that I'm pretty sure I know the answer to, but using my example earlier where I can use some AI program to shortcut my knowledge of Excel and present data information in useful and actionable ways probably is okay. If I, however, am that person you describe who doesn't have any close relationships, feels isolated, feels like I don't know quite where my place is in the world, relying on AI through like a chatbot to start conversations, to sort of pose big questions, to get feedback about life decisions, things that like generations ago you would talk to these things called, I don't know if you've heard this word, friends. People had friends at one time. That when you sort of outsource that to AI, that's much more dangerous, I'm guessing you're going to say, than outsourcing intermediate Excel skills.
Yes. And it's not, these are not dangers that are incidental to the intended use of these programs. This is OpenAI says teens use their chatbot for, quote, support, learning, and creativity. This is the intended use. They're tracking this use, and they're saying this is a good thing. I would say the chatbot undermines support because what it does is it replaces real relationships with fake relationships. And so ultimately, it gives you a simulacrum, or like a artificial kind of support that will ultimately fail in crisis. It replaces learning. It doesn't contribute to learning. So it gives you a fake, it gives you access to information, but it deprives the developing brain of the whole process of what learning traditionally involved. And it doesn't enhance creativity. It allows you to produce things that seem creative, but it's not coming from you. I mean, creativity is kind of a magical thing that happens when you get really engaged with some material and you turn it into something new, like it can be poetry or music or painting. It does that stuff for you. So it's not, you're not using it for creativity. You're like, it's doing it. Like these promises are all false. And so what's the point of it? Can you tell I'm a little bit angry about it?
Well, yeah. And so here's sort of my take on it. And I think we've talked this before. I've spent more time on these AI platforms than you have. And we've also talked a lot about how other like social media platforms are fine-tuned to keep you on their platforms by showing you things that they know you like. The example we gave in a recent show was, I like baseball, so it's going to show me a lot of baseball content.
Yeah.
AI does that in a different way. How AI will do that is it will say things like, if you were chatting with it, wow, Rick, that's a really insightful question. Let me give you a few things to think about. And you might think, well, I think I'd like to explore number three more. That's really interesting. And it's just very reaffirming with whatever you want to, whatever you point toward it. And when you talk about education, or whether you talk about these more casual interactions, I think to me, one of the more dangerous things is it never comes back to you and says, but are you asking the right question? Because that's a key difference to me. Like, yep. You know, you could, if you're wanting to go down a whole topic about something serious or not serious, you can probably have that conversation for a really long time. But it seems rare, if ever, in my experience and others from what I've heard, that it will say, you know, you really are, there's a whole area here we're not talking about. Let's talk about this instead, because it's afraid, just like the social media algorithm's not going to send me hockey content because I'm a baseball fan. These platforms in the AI world don't seem to want to show you things that are going to make you say, yeah, I don't care about that, and I'll move on to something else. And I think that is sort of the untalked about, at least in my experience, danger of these programs, is it's always so affirming of what you give it.
Well, when you read these stories about AI chatbots advising teens on suicide or on eating disorders, and it's encouraging them, that is why it's doing it, because it's designed to be affirming. And so, like, it develops what seems to be a relationship. It's not really a relationship, because, of course, it's just a program that's picked up through these large language learning models. It's picking up combinations of words and phrases that are designed to be intelligible to human beings, but also to increase the amount of time that you will spend interacting with the program. And so it's designed to be affirming. And so this is not a bug that it happens to encourage suicide, encourage anorexia, and like all kinds of, I would say, disordered or pathological ways of thinking about one's life. It does that because if you're kind of leaning towards that in the beginning, it's designed to be affirmative. And the response of the companies is, oh, we're still working out the bugs. Why are we doing beta testing on our kids?
It kind of reminds me, when you were, or I were a kid, and I don't think either of us remember spending time in our cribs, but I'm sure the cribs we were in looked much different than the cribs a new parent would buy today.
Yeah.
Because there is like studies that show like, kids getting their heads lodged in between the rails and these things that we just know are dangerous. But also, a crib only has so many parts, right? I mean, it may seem like a lot of parts when you're putting it together, but it only still has so many parts. And I think that's probably why this is certainly more challenging than building a crib, is because you're not just dealing with things that are seen in the physical world and say, well, we're not going to space the rails, 8 inches apart. We'll make them 3 inches apart or whatever they might be. And I suppose that's why it makes it more difficult. But if you look at this danger to children and to maybe the society at large, it seems that there's three places where we can apply pressure to make this safer. And that's at the government and regulatory level. It's at the responsibility of these platforms like OpenAI and Perplexity, et cetera, or three, it's at the personal responsibility or parental level. I'm guessing you think that all of these places are failing to exert control over this, but which of those do you think has the most responsibility?
I think right now it's mostly on the what we'd call the manufacturer side.
In effect, the people making the crib. Weird metaphor.
Yeah, and we have models for, for how we think about product liability, going way back. And there was a time prior to industrialization, we didn't really have laws regarding that. But then you get mass productions of things, and then you start getting things that are sold in large numbers and they're sold by designers. As they get more complicated, we put more responsibility onto the design and manufacture of a product than onto the buying of it. Now, if you have very simple items, like say a crib or a ladder, I mean, they can be quite dangerous, but they're also very simple.
Yes.
And so what you do, like ladders have warnings, all stickers on them. And like, if it's a step ladder, don't stand on this top step, okay? Somebody might still do it and injure themselves. But there's only so much safety that the manufacturer could put into it. But if you notice, for example, if you buy a wooden stepladder, there's often like a wire piece underneath that wooden dowel so that won't break, right, to support it. Or like there are still some standards, like even something very simple, there's standards we expect the manufacturer to abide by, and then there's the responsible use side. Now, as you get more complicated, you take up like a car.
More complicated than a crib.
Much more complicated. And so we had I think it was in 1984 or something with the Ford Pinto, the gas tanks were exploding.
Yes.
Right? And people were being engulfed in flames inside their vehicles, especially after low-speed accidents, rear-end collisions. That's something that you can't expect the buyer to know. You can go around, you kick the tire, you take it for a test drive, but you can't really tell by looking at it or test driving it that like you're going to be liable to die in a horrible fiery explosion if somebody rear-ends you. That's on the manufacturer. And it turned out that Ford had data that it collected on those kinds of accidents, and it hid the data because it was afraid of lawsuits. And sure enough, they got sued, and they were responsible. But then the government steps in and starts saying, we have standards for the manufacturer of these things, and we're going to have product testing. That's why we have something like the FDA saying, like, we're not going to just let a company like Eli Lilly to release a new drug that they think is promising. We're going to do all kinds of controlled testing to make sure it's promising, not only in its short-term but long-term effects before we release it. Because if I'm taking a blood pressure medication as a consumer, it's just a little pill. I have no way of evaluating whether it's safe or not. So they have to do it. AI is like that. We're doing it exactly the opposite. Here we're taking something that's incredibly complex, that has profound effects on people. We don't know what either the short-term or long-term effects of many of these products and uses of the products are. And we're releasing it right to the public and saying, buyer beware. And it's irresponsible both of the manufacturers, and it's irresponsible of our government to do that.
So if the government at the moment seems to be failing us, and the producers of these products, in your mind, are...
Look at who's sitting around the dinner table with Trump.
Yeah, yeah.
These are the heads of those companies.
Heads of those companies, yeah, correct. And the Trump administration has seemed to have little interest in putting guardrails around AI at this moment.
And I don't think the Senate or Congress has either, because they're receiving massive donations. Look, four AI companies were responsible for 60% of the stock market growth in the past year. And so, I mean, when that's the case, there's not much incentive from investors. There's not much incentive from members of Congress. But it's still a responsible thing to do. I mean, just like, yeah, people were making a lot of money. I use this analogy to like the OxyContin before. Mm-hmm. Like investors and companies and a lot of politicians were getting huge donations from the pharmaceutical companies for the sale of these products. That didn't make it right.
So before we close on this, if you're correct that the government regulatory system seems at the moment to have no interest in reining this in, that the companies themselves seem to just be wanting to push these out more quickly and continue to release more feature-rich products all the time, it seems like the only possible way to try to thwart this is individually in our own lives, right? That we can make choices ourselves whether to use these things and wait and hope that there'll be pressure applied through either the tort process or through the legislative process. But what individually, I guess, and maybe I'll ask you directly, you don't seem to be the strongest fan I've heard about AI. What do you, as someone who feels that way pretty strongly, how does that change how you interact with these things? Because, you know, it just seems like the other day I was booking a reservation on OpenTable, which is a place you can go and book restaurant reservations. And I realized I hadn't used it in maybe a month or two. And it's one of those things I liked because you can go on there and it's like super easy. You type in a time, a place, wherever city you're in, gives you a few restaurants, and it's like a 2-minute process. And I was on it for the first time in a couple of months, and there were all sorts of like AI widgets in there now. And I'm a little hazy now on what they all did, but I think it was like, tell me what you're looking for and we'll try to create just the perfect restaurant match for you, which I didn't want to do. I just knew what I wanted. And so I'm like, oh, this is just like another step to get through, but I want to, and it took me, instead of 2 minutes, it may have taken me three. But I use that as an example because anybody who uses any corner of the internet now has these like AI tools or widgets or assistants sort of layered on top of these experiences. How do you react to those? Or what do you ever like find yourself wanting to maybe try them out? Or as someone who seems to be pretty solidly anti-AI, do you just say, no, this is just not for me?
Yeah, I'll try them out.
Okay.
I want to know how they're working. I try them out.
Are you doing it just that you're curious intellectually, or you're like, this may help me accomplish what I'm trying to do?
Some of both. I'm really concerned about the overall effects on children.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I don't have any young children anymore, but if I did, I would be really worried. And I would be going to school board meetings, and I would be demanding that school board make some really strong policies about it. And that's where I think that you know, ordinary citizens can be effective. As far as personal use, like where it comes down to where I really have some kind of interaction with it is mostly like in my job as a professor, and I'm finding that like I can't assign a lot of the essays I used to assign because I don't know which ones are written by AI.
Like take-home essays, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so we just more in-class assignments and require more handwritten stuff, mm-hmm. and require more like verbal feedback. And it's probably in some ways kind of a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like require students to give presentations. Mm-hmm. Now, they might have had AI help in doing the presentation, but if you give a presentation in front of the class and you have to answer questions about it, it still requires that you have some mastery of the material.
At this moment, we don't have AI hardwired into our brains.
Right. I mean, so those are some of the ways, like professionally, I found that I've had to change some things that I do. But here's like, we can't count on the manufacturers and we can't count on government. In fact, we can count on the manufacturers pretty much to deceive us and to manipulate us into, like, because they have a huge incentive to find uses of it because they've invested so much money. Microsoft has invested something like $60 billion into this, and it hasn't got the returns yet,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it's trying to find ways of getting the return. So it's trying to find every possible use and convince us that we need it, even when it's like a much worse product. The other day, my wife and I were traveling in the car, and I said, like, I wonder when the Packers game is going to be on. This was like a few days before the first opening weekend, and I said, I don't know what time are the Packers playing on Sunday. And she said, I don't know. I'll look it up. And she looks it up and says, it says they're playing today, and now it says like they lost that game and they lost by 14 points, and it was on a Monday night, and like we're a few days before the first week, and like this was impossible.
It was pulling from last year, assuming.
Yeah, yeah. But it was conflating all this different information and putting it into an AI summary, which you get in most searches now.
Yes.
Microsoft
it's unusual
search, Google search. Yeah. And I've found this over and over. I'll ask a question or, you know, type in a phrase looking for some information, and it will pull stuff out of context. And unless you already know a little bit about what you're looking for, you can't recognize that it's false. So right now, it's a much worse product than we used to have, but they're using it because they're trying to find a market for something that they have to get a return on this substantial investment. So we can't count on the companies. You can't count on Congress to do something. I am really grateful that we still have investigative journalism. And so it was just recently that Washington Post came out with an exclusive report. The title is Meta Suppressed Research on Child Safety, Employees Say. And they quote one of the top researchers there on child safety, Jason Sadazan, told the Washington Post that their bosses of a team of researchers had ordered them to delete data on child safety. According to an employee testifying before Congress, Meta's legal team was, quote, seeking to establish plausible deniability about the negative effect of its products. I mean, this is why I think it's really important to subscribe to papers that do like old-fashioned, the real hard work of investigative reporting. This is old-school journalism. This is getting on the phone, talking to people, interviewing them, quoting them, looking through the records of the Senate hearings. And I think, by the way, this is why you subscribe to your local Lee newspaper. You want reporting in your local community. Otherwise, there's going to be corruption going on that doesn't get uncovered, because the only way it gets uncovered is through good reporting. We need it right now in a big way to uncover what's going on with AI, because I think there are all kinds of things going on at all of these companies because they have this huge financial investment. They're in a race, as you pointed out, with the Chinese companies and with one another. They want to be the first to get established in different kind of market areas, and they're covering up the harm that's being done.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, what is your question for me?
Scott, this question comes from a dilemma posed. It was in one of the articles that we read a couple weeks ago for a podcast that we referred to, and I'm forgetting it now. But the person described what had happened when it was somebody who lived on a rural road, and they had a new neighbor that had moved in along the road, and I think it was like across the street or something. They had had some friends over, and the friends parked along that road. Now, what you do on these rural roads, if you're not familiar with it, you have to pull off of the shoulders.
They're often narrow.
You pull off into the side. Sometimes, like there's the ditch or something, you pull part ways into the ditch. Apparently, this is one of those areas where the neighbor had probably mowed the ditch or something, so like that regarded as this part of their lawn or something. But she was incensed that this guy's friends had parked on her property and wanted him to make sure it never happened again. And I'm just wondering, if you were in that situation, what would you do about that?
A couple of things. First, I think it's important to note in this dilemma you outlined that in most cases with which I'm familiar, that area you're talking about, even in rural areas, is often part of the right-of-way, meaning it is, even though the homeowner may mow it and maintains it into whatever level it needs being maintained, it's typically public space, just like the roadway is, because the public space doesn't end where the cement or blacktop ends. It usually extends, I don't know, 8 to 12 feet.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Yeah, but plenty of room to pull a car over.
Absolutely. And so this, your dilemma reminds me of an old saying that I think, you remember the old saying, fences make good neighbors,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, we could have a discussion about whether that's true. But in some ways, it reminded me that curbs probably also make good neighbors, because even something as, you know, I think few people are not, you know, and if there were had been a curb there, which these rural roads almost never have, it would have kind of been more of like, oh, I'm not going to go over the curb. But these are how you describe it. There's sort of a hard surface road, and then it kind of has a gravel shoulder, and then it just sort of turned into a grassy area that may dip down into a ditch, and then sitting back 50 feet is someone's house, something more
right.
Like that. So the person in that house, in your scenario, approaches me and says, you had six or eight people over the other night that had six or eight cars, and some of those people had pulled over and were parking in, her term might be, my yard, and I don't like that happening, and please, the next time this happens, tell them not to do that. I guess a couple of things come to mind. I think when you're dealing with somebody who is new to your community or your neighborhood, I should say, I think you want to get off on the right foot. And is this the first time I've had any interaction with this neighbor?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is, you know what, and I think there's also realization that it's quite possible, especially due to this reaction, that she may never have lived along a road like this. If she, like me, lives in a traditional city neighborhood where there are curbs, this may seem different. And so I guess the question is, do you try to, I guess there's three approaches. You can kind of blow up at her and tell her what an idiot she is. Probably not the best way to start a neighborhood relationship. You try to educate and say, well, you know, here's how it kind of works. And, you know, because the roads are narrow and because there's this right of way and this has been going on a long time and try to be a little bit of an educator, or say, and at least in my case, although we sometimes have groups of like 6 or 8 people come over, it happens so infrequently that maybe the next time that happens, I would go out of my way to say, hey, if you could just, you know, pull up on my side of the road because we have a neighbor who doesn't appreciate that. So to me, those seem like the three approaches you could take. I think number one's bad. We can agree on that. Just like saying what an idiot she is, she should know better. I would likely, I mean, if this were going to be happening all the time with, and there's really no way to, like, let's say I have a small business out of my home and people are going to be stopping by that I don't know, unannounced all the time, that I probably would try to explain to her in a polite way that this is just sort of, you know, going to happen. And I can't really have these conversations with everybody who wants to stop by my little home office because I just can't do that. So sorry, but try to do it in a nice way. But if this is the like happens occasionally and there's people I know, I might honestly try to contact them and say, hey, in the future, could you do this? With the hope that over time, this person who is quite possibly new to living in the country, spends more time in the country, drives up and down these roads more often, maybe meets other people, maybe even visits other, and then starts to realize that, you know what? This is the way things are done here. And my hope would be that over time, that would become less of an issue. But if I could try to not get that new neighborhood relation off on a bad foot, I would sincerely say to her, thanks for letting me know. And if it is possible, try to avoid that from happening in the future. That would be my approach. And I don't know if I would go down the educational path right away.
Yeah. And I think you kind of suggested this. You might go down a little bit of the educational path just by asking some questions and finding out, does she likely know, like this is the way a lot of people do it around here.
Or you can even say, I see you're new here. Where did you move here from? Oh, I lived in downtown Chicago my entire life. Oh, well, okay. Then you can kind of put that little nugget in the back of your mind, realizing there might be some other things she may be surprised to learn about living in the country.
Yeah. I think it's a pretty good response. You know, I don't think there's ever going to be any hard and fast rules for how to get along with a difficult neighbor.
Yeah.
You know, and
we don't know that she's going to be difficult based on this.
You don't know. But you're going to find out.
Yes.
Right? But in advance, you have to give her the benefit of the doubt. Maybe she just doesn't know how things are done. And you can be accommodated, like you said. If this is something that's going to happen like once a month, you're going to have a group of friends over, tell them, try to avoid her property.
Yeah.
And you can let her know that.
What if the second interaction with her is like, oh, here's something else you're doing wrong. And then the third interaction is here's something else you're doing wrong. And then the fourth, et cetera. Then it probably becomes like, okay, this is just one of those not great neighbors. And that's fine. But that's when I would start to maybe be less. I guess that's what I would probably stop telling my friends about their parking, unless you truly believe that she's going to do something dastardly. I mean, if she's going to like, you know, do really bad things, and then that's a whole nother. But I think few people are going to go out there and because somebody pulled up alongside their yard, they're going to go out there and, you know, egg the car or you know, key the side. I mean, that seems like pretty extreme behavior that I think most people would never do.
Would you try to restart the relationship by, say, the next day bringing her over some cookies or something?
Oh, I don't necessarily do that, but I would try to. I mean, I think it's trickier though. I mean, just by the way, I'm picturing this layout of this more rural area is that these houses are probably spread further apart. You aren't going to have, like I do, sort of these incidental interactions with your neighbors that you just have because you're 30 feet away versus 300 feet away. So, yeah, I mean, maybe there is. I guess I can't see myself bringing the plate of cookies or whatever the thing is.
Maybe zucchini.
I would be happy to get rid of any zucchini.
Right.
I didn't like zucchini at all. But, I don't know. Maybe I would try to find some way to make the next interaction positive. I'm not exactly sure what that would look like. But I think that would be a good thing. And also sort of for my knowledge to make sure that this person isn't just going to be a bad egg and somebody who's going to be trouble no matter what I do, because I don't think I would not want to make that judgment based on this parking discussion.
I think you should just give her zucchini, because that way you make a gesture of goodwill and get rid of something you don't want anyway.
But then the danger is she is actually a very nice person and makes me zucchini bread and brings it back the next day. And that's
I didn't think about that. So there's the unanticipated consequences.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. Well, at least we agree on zucchini is not great.
No.
Okay. And it's this time of the year when many people are happy to give you their surplus zucchini harvest.
It's the fruitcake of the garden.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to check out Rick's column, which is always about ethics and has yet to include recipes for zucchini bread. And that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I'm Scott Rada. Thanks for listening.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Weight loss solutions are not one size fits all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you. With 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.